Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
BP Chief Executive Tony Hayward made a brief public statement today. He said the company is going to do what it takes to make things right down on the Gulf Coast.
BP will be here for a very long time.
Assuming, of course, that BP itself is still around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the 3rd of June. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Today was a not-so-bad day for BP, truth be told. It finally got that bit of pipe sliced off the wellhead down on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. Its U.S.-traded shares actually rose today in New York. But there was less happy news for the company, too. The ratings agencies, Moody's and Fitch, remember we told you about them yesterday, they downgraded BP's bonds a notch. BP debt does still carry one of the highest investment ratings you can get, but both agencies warned of more downgrades to come if the company can't figure out what to do about that leak and pronto. The longer this whole thing lasts, the bigger the doubts about BP's future, both about how it's going to pay the bills and, in fact, whether it might survive at all. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Estimates of the ultimate cost of the disaster have soared. The Credit Suisse bank now reckons BP's final bill could hit more than $30 billion. Chris Grabowski of Peak Oil Consulting says that could force BP into a fire sale.
It's certainly possible that they will have to sell off certain assets. In fact, the idea has been floated today that they maybe will sell off their Alaska holdings.
A highly valuable asset, says Grabowski. Alaskan fields supplied one in every 14 barrels of oil that BP pumped worldwide last year. Its operations in the Gulf of Mexico were an even bigger source of crude.
I suppose a possibility might be to sell a big chunk of that and bring in a partner, an American partner. It could solve two problems at once.
Raising cash and deflecting some American hostility towards BP. But most analysts say talk of an asset fire sale is premature. BP is an immensely rich company with low debt and huge profits. Jason Kenny of the Dutch bank ING says the threat to BP's been wildly exaggerated.
Our base case assumption for the cost of the U.S. Gulf of Mexico is about $5.5 billion. Even if you quadruple it, it's only a year's profit for BP.
Much depends, however, on the eventual cost of legal settlements and claims, which could be stratospheric. After it's finally plugged the leak, BP's next major challenge will be capping the liabilities that flow from this disaster. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
New York Times economics columnist David Leonhardt has been writing about why the blowout on the Deepwater Horizon happened. Not really the mechanics of it at all, but more the human nature of it. David, hello again.
Thank you, Kai. It's good to be on.
The drive for profits and how that affected some of BP's actions, we have all read and heard much about in the past 6 weeks. You, though, this past weekend in the magazine, brought up another point, something else that might have been, you know, a bit more human involved.
That's right. First of all, I agree the drive for profits played a big role. And I think it interacted with this other more universally human issue, which is we're not very good at estimating the odds of something that is unlikely, but that brings huge costs, like an oil rig essentially blowing up.
Or like, gee, I don't know, the entire U.S. housing industry going
That's right.
down the drain, right?
That's right. So one of the justifications we heard for the housing bubble was that, well, no, we're not in a huge bubble because we've never been in one before. Basically, what they said was house prices have never fallen nationally. You had people on Wall Street, as Michael Lewis has reported, building models that didn't even allow for the possibility that house prices would fall. And so what they did a bad job of doing was saying, okay, how should we deal with this thing that we think is unlikely, but that if it happens, based on the edifice that we have built, could cause terrible damage to the United States economy. And because they had a hard time imagining it, they didn't take the necessary precautions.
Well, let me ask you this, though. I mean, that's the underestimation of risk. What about the overestimation of something happening?
That happens as well. When something is very easy to imagine, we often overestimate its odds of happening. One example of that is plane crashes. We think they're much more common than they really are. We tend to react to them more than we react to car crashes, for example, when in fact plane crashes are much less common than car crashes and kill many fewer people.
Is there a market mechanism that can correct this bias that we have?
Yes and no. To some extent, there's nothing we can do to magically get rid of this bias. But that being said, you want to design policies that would push back against it. What's tragic in this case is that we actually had a policy that aggravated it. We have capped the amount of damages that oil companies would pay from a spill like this. And if anything, that encourages them to take more risk, to not worry about these odds.
This is that $75 million cap that was put in place after the Exxon Valdez. And your point is that the BP guys who were making the decisions said, yeah, we don't have to worry so much because all we're going to have to pay is $75 million.
That certainly seems like a reasonable supposition to make. You have to think that encourages them to take more risk, to not worry about these odds.
Mm-hmm. So as we prepare for the inevitable slew of new rules and regulations that will follow this event, I'd guess it's your position that we're likely not to get it right, that we're going to put something in place that down the road we will say, oh, man, this we didn't think this through.
That's right. And we're specifically not likely to get it right in the following way. We are likely to overreact to this specific disaster, the one we can now easily imagine. But we are certainly likely to take not enough steps to prevent other similar catastrophes.
Or just to bring it back to business and the economy, a financial crisis that will happen not like the one that we just had.
That's right. The next one is not going to involve the housing market. Maybe it's going to involve something else that's even harder to imagine. We shouldn't always be so comfortable that everything is going to work out okay.
David Leonhardt, the staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, also an economics columnist for the newspaper. David, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Okay, moving on now from oil. We learned today April showers most definitely did not lead to May flowers for some retailers. Sales were below expectations at stores from Abercrombie & Fitch to JCPenney. A lot of the analyst chatter when the figures came out this morning blamed the weather. That is something you often hear from businesses when things don't go as well as they'd hoped. Usually, though, there's at least a snowstorm or something big they can point to. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson looks into today's blame game.
Analysts say heavy rain in the Pacific Northwest and cool temperatures everywhere but the Northeast led to lackluster sales in May. I asked Jim Ramsey, a meteorologist at WGN in Chicago, how the weather's been there.
The El Nino pattern has been largely responsible by most estimates for providing us with just a delightful spring.
A delightful spring, you say?
Here in the upper Midwest, we've had three consecutive years with more than 50 inches of snow. It takes a little more than a cool down to cause people to not go shopping.
But some retail analysts say that's not the case in an economic slump. Bert Flickinger is managing director of the consumer consulting firm Strategic Resource Group.
The cooler weather does have an effect because consumer confidence is 50% of where it was 2 years ago. So consumers are constantly looking to postpone purchases.
For instance, he says consumers might put off buying summer clothes until June. That's no good for the stores because they need cash to buy fall merchandise now. But don't retailers plan for the weather like the rest of us? I asked Frank Badillo, a senior economist at Kantar Retail.
Too often it is a handy excuse for what goes on in any given month. And as an economist, when I look at the numbers, I typically find that there are other reasons that far outweigh weather.
Like big declines in the stock market last month, he says. Or, you know, the recession. Then again, it's probably easier to just
blame it on the rain.
Even if doing so is about as believable as Milli Vanilli singing their own songs. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It was a calmish day on Wall Street today, weather-wise and stock-wise. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Game one of the NBA Finals is tonight, just down the street from Marketplace World Headquarters here in Los Angeles. In a league where showboating superstars are usually the center of attention, though, this year the playoffs have served up baseball's greatest team rivalry, the Lakers and the Boston Celtics. No other teams have dominated the history of the NBA, really, like those two have. And even though hot young phenoms like LeBron James are going to be sitting this one out, advertisers are banking on a rather old-fashioned combination of nostalgia and great basketball. Jeff Horowitz reports.
This year's NBA Finals will feature plenty of star players. Kobe Bryant, of course, Kevin Garnett. Also, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson.
Magic with a hook shot, scores with two. And the Celtics trail by one with 2 seconds to go.
This will be a series that features players, but maybe not just today's stars.
David Carter runs the Sports Business Institute at USC. The Celtics and Lakers have met 10 times in the finals. Together, they dominated the 80s. Carter says advertisers are lining up to cash in on that nostalgia.
This is one of the premier rivalries in all of sports, akin to the Red Sox and the Yankees. So I think that when you consider these major media markets, these storied franchises, I think it tees up rather nicely.
How nicely? ABC is guaranteeing advertisers about 14.6 million viewers a game. John Lombardo with Sports Business Journal says that's 300,000 more than last year's L.A.-Orlando matchup.
I think that ABC is, and the NBA is counting on, a heated rivalry that goes beyond the NBA fan to more of a casual sports fan.
For now, ticket prices are one leading indicator of the power of this matchup. Russ D'Souza of SeatGeek.com says prices on what's politely called the secondary market, also known as scalpers, have soared.
The highest ticket price that we've seen is actually for Game 2, where we saw ticket transactions that were $752 on average.
D'Souza says prices remain high even into the sixth and seventh games. That means fans expect a long, hard-fought series. For advertisers and the NBA, those extra games are worth way more than a few LeBron James slam dunks. I'm Jeff Horowitz for Marketplace.
Finance ministers from the G20 countries are meeting today in South Korea. They're going to be talking about a whole bunch of things. First among them, the ongoing unease in European financial markets. Part of what they're worried about is a repeat of Wall Street circa 2008, when bankers started doing the same thing at the same time, not lending because everybody else wasn't lending. Commentator Casey Cole says they couldn't really help themselves.
Monkey see, monkey do. It's not a new observation. We're all natural mimics, especially in close-knit groups. Take any bunch of journalists, senators, gangsters, truckers, or Wall Street bankers, and you'll find an astonishing array of similarities in the way they dress, walk, think, spend money, even raise children. It's all rather amusing until it gets out of control. That is, when a couple of really bad actors influence a whole religion or industry until bad actor becomes the default position. And yes, I'm talking about religious extremists, but I'm also talking about Goldman Sachs and their whole entitled ilk. How did bankers behaving badly get to be so normal that people barely notice? Recently, science has thrown its 2 cents in. Neuroscientists have known for years that if one monkey reaches for a banana and a second monkey watches, the same neurons fire in the watching monkey as in the monkey who grabbed the banana. Okay, monkeys are monkeys, but this year, for the first time, researchers at UCLA made direct recordings of such mirror neurons at work in the human brain. Humans see, humans do. There's a definite upside to all this. We cry at weddings because our mirror neurons get soppy right along with the brides. We scream in slasher movies because neurons in our brains mimic those in the mind of the victim. Alas, this kind of unconscious mimicry requires absolutely no understanding of the actions or emotions involved, no thought to what we are doing or why. What's worse, we like people who mimic us, so we keep them around, multiplying the effect. What's this got to do with bankers behaving badly? For starters, bankers could dump that "me too, everybody does it" attitude and think about what values they're reflecting. Mirror, mirror on the wall, save us from a big Dow fall.
Casey Cole's most recent book is called Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens. Send us your thoughts, wonderful or not. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. Coming up, marketing music through your cell phone.
If you look at the way that media is being consumed across the globe, cell phones are the number one site that everyone's trying to figure out how to actually maximize cell phones for all kinds of media content.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials inched up less than 0.1% today. That is 5 points, closed at 10,255. The NASDAQ rose roughly 1%, 21 points, closed at 2303. The S&P 500 hiked 0.4%, 4 points, ended at 1102. Energy companies had a mixed day. ConocoPhillips slid 1%. Chevron dribbled down 0.3%. Valero Energy moved higher, closed up 2%. ExxonMobil rose 1%. Financials lost ground as investors continue to worry about possibly troubled banks over in Europe. Goldman Sachs off 0.5%. J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo all lost more than 1%. Today, Citigroup gained a little ground, ended the day 1% higher. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.37%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. And by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, a closely watched economic indicator is released. The Labor Department reports unemployment figures for May. Activists are planning a protest at BP's Washington, D.C. headquarters. And President Obama is scheduled to be back at the site of the BP oil spill, his third trip since the explosion on April 20th. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Census Bureau said today it's got 573,000 people on its payroll. When their work is done and this year's census is in the books, it's expected to show that the Latino population in the United States has topped 50 million. That is a market worth as much as $1 trillion. Businesses obviously want a piece of it, but getting there is way more complicated than just translating your ads from English to Spanish. So some of America's biggest brands are collaborating to try to win over the Hispanic consumer. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The Latinum Network includes about 30 companies, brands like Clorox, H&R Block, Subway, and McDonald's. Mike Klein is co-founder of Latinum.
What we're most interested in is understanding this consumer and how they're similar and different from consumers in the rest of the economy.
The network combs through Hispanic demographic data. Then it shares best practices with its members, like the NBA. Earlier in the season, the New York Knicks put the data into practice.
Damas y caballeros, el cuadro titular de tu New York Knicks.
Across the country, teams staged Noche Latina, or Latin Night, to honor Hispanic fans. Their numbers have grown 10% in the last year. An ad for the NBA shows just how devoted some of those fans are. That's the sound of two Hispanic guys who screamed so much during the game that they lost their voices. To give Hispanic fans their own voice, the NBA developed a second brand called NBA.
Essentially what NBA is how our Hispanic fans already refer to our league. La NBA. We basically took it and made it official.
That's Saskia Sorosa, Senior Director of U.S. Hispanic Marketing for the NBA. She says research shows Hispanics like to be acknowledged, but don't like to be identified solely by language.
When we were deciding how to rebrand our league, you know, did we want to call it NBA in Espanol? Did we want to call it NBA Latino? And that was calling them out or singling them out a little too much, but NBA was almost like a wink.
Some of the distinctions are subtle. Others challenge conventional assumptions.
Mike Klein with Latinum says Hispanic families do tend to be bigger with more kids.
But it's also true that half of all Hispanic households in the U.S. are childless.
Cultural traditions are not uniform either. In the past, Hispanic mothers tended to cook meals from scratch. Klein says that's changing.
More and more Hispanic women are beginning to work, and there may be dual-income households. And so, like the non-Hispanic consumer, Hispanics are beginning now to spend more on frozen foods.
How does this research play out in the real world? In Chicago, 7-Eleven is putting Latinum's data to the test. The convenience store chain has a pilot program aimed at blue-collar Hispanic consumers. That means new bilingual signs over the coffee bar and different products. Irene Sivaja is Senior Director of Hispanic Marketing for 7-Eleven.
So here we are in the snack section, and there's a whole bunch of snacks that we can bring in here, like chili-covered tamarind, dried shrimp.
But she says the network's research shows Hispanic customers don't want all the Mexican products bunched together in an ethnic section.
That sends a message that says, here, this three-foot section is for you, and the rest of the store is for everybody else.
Kunal Nakodkar knows what it's like to be homesick for food. The owner of this 7-Eleven franchise emigrated from India to Chicago.
We had to travel about 20 miles to an Indian neighbor to get all that Indian food.
His experiences help him appreciate the needs of his immigrant customers. Even before the pilot program started, he would stock refried beans and hot sauce.
So that way they don't have to travel as I did.
His efforts have paid off. Nakodkar says his Hispanic customers have been fiercely loyal, and they increase his business by bringing their friends. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
I suppose it's possible to have almost as many cell phone ringtones out there as there are cell phones themselves. Most of them, though, probably don't sound much like something you'd want to listen to on the radio. You see what I mean, right? But mobile phones and how they let us know there is somebody on the line are becoming more musically relevant. Instead of downloading a real song to their iPods or MP3 players, a lot of people are downloading straight to their cell phones, especially one set of music and ringtone lovers, fans of traditional Mexican music. Josh Kuhn teaches at the University of Southern California. He directs the Popular Music Project at the Lear Center there. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Mexican bands and ringtones, what's up?
A lot. In the ringtone market, bands representing the genre known in the U.S. as regional Mexican music. Ringtones are a huge business for regional Mexican bands, or I should say regional Mexican bands are a huge business for ringtone providers and for major labels.
Why? I mean, where'd that come from?
You know, ringtones are obviously very much mobile phone, cell phone based. Mm-hmm. And for regional Mexican music, the cell phone has really become one of the dominant ways of experiencing regional Mexican music in the United States.
So a lot of fans of regional Mexican music that we're talking about here, they use their cell phones as the player, not an iPhone or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, to be specific here, when we're talking about regional Mexican music, banda music, norteño music, ranchera, this is music that is, for the most part, exclusively listened to by working class, specifically Mexican migrant audiences and their kids.
Got it.
The numbers tend to skew that in the quote-unquote general market, roughly 80% of all digital downloads occur online and only 20% on cell phones. In the regional Mexican market, those numbers are flipped.
Wow.
And a lot of that has to do with really the popularity of the cell phone as a really handy,
sure,
portable, cheap device, but also very importantly that you can buy phone plans as pay-as-you-go cash plans. For an iTunes account, you need a credit card. You need a credit history.
Right.
And for many, but not all, but for many migrant listeners, those things are harder to come by.
Okay, so you can't do a segment like this without actually playing some of those ringtones.
Yeah.
So here's what we're going to do, and I go into this naming of the band segment with the caveat that I'm a Chinese speaker, not a Spanish speaker. So here we go. This is a band called Los Picadientes de Caborca, and it's a song called La Cumbia del Rio. We're going to play that, and then you're gonna tell me about it. All right. So that's kind of a good tune, and it's unbelievably popular.
Yes. This tune originally was recorded in Mexico by this band who basically did it in their living room. And it's a fairly silly song about dancing a cumbia by the side of the river.
Yeah.
They recorded it on their computers at home. And then they then started sharing it with their friends in their town by cell phone.
Huh.
And more of their friends started listening to it on their cell phones. And most importantly, many of them started actually recording themselves on their cell phone cameras doing funny dances to this song. And those videos of those dances ended up on YouTube. And all those YouTube videos became so popular that it ended up getting the band signed to Sony here in the States. And Sony was smart enough to realize that this band's popularity really was all about cell phones and YouTube, that when they filmed the quote-unquote official video for the song, all it is really a mashup of all of the unofficial videos that started out.
Regional Mexican is one thing. Does this translate into other kinds of music, though?
I mean, the regional Mexican story has been a pretty specific one because of the nature of the demographics of the immigrant workforce. That said, I do think, you know, if you look at the way that that media is being consumed across the globe, cell phones are the number one site that everyone's trying to figure out how to actually maximize cell phones for all kinds of media content. And so I do think it's becoming a kind of new kind of global experience where the cell phone as a mobile tool, a portable tool, and an expensive one, a kind of disposable tool, is now the dominant way that people are experiencing everything from songs to TV shows to webisodes to, you know, films.
Yeah, it's the mobilization of content.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Josh Kuhn from the Annenberg School at USC, just down the road. Josh, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today by way of the Marketplace Education Desk, Walmart has a new offering, online college degrees. The catch is you have to work there. The world's biggest retailer announced a new education employee education program today, rather. It's kind of a big deal, mostly because Walmart's got 1.5 million people working there. And if most of them or even some of them get a college degree, that's a net positive. But the best part, the Arkansas-based company isn't partnering with the University of Arkansas or Arkansas State. It's going for a for-profit partner. Our stories on for-profit universities are on our website. It's marketplace.org. There's some pretty good ones. You ought to listen. But for now, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow pumped up 5 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ up 21 points, roughly 1%. The S&P 500 added 4 points. That is 0.4%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, having your cheese say cheese, introducing food paparazzi.
The idea of paparazzi definitely has a negative connotation to it, almost like, you know, a shoe fly. And what we're doing here in meat is out of passion. We love food.
I don't know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.